We're trying to be inclusive in our practices. So obviously this is a DEISJ lens. And thinking about how we're making sure that equity approaches all the work. I know for me personally, and I believe also for TJ, I believe that's what will make the next associations over the next couple of years and decades thrive and survive. You can't ignore being aligned with your values. I think you can't ignore thinking about how equity and justice, and this is in the sense of everyone having a voice, not just certain people. So it's not necessarily silencing certain perspectives, but I think making sure everyone can raise their perspective and voice.
This is Associations Thrive, the podcast celebrating successful associations and their leaders. I'm your host, Joanna Pineda, CEO and Chief Troublemaker at Matrix Group International. Listen in as top association executives tell all, revealing the creative and innovative ways they're increasing membership, generating revenue, nurturing engagement, and reimagining their organizations. By the way, if you've launched a new initiative, created new member services, or updated your governance structure and are seeing great results, I want to hear your story and so do my listeners. I'd love to have you as a guest. Go to podcast.matrixgroup.net and apply to be on Associations Thrive. Now let's dive into this week's show. Today, I'm speaking with Nathan Victoria, Executive Director of the Society for Personality Assessment and Vice President of Next Gen Association Management. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Joanna. Excited to be here.
Nathan, let's start with SPA. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So SPA is the Society for Personality Assessment. We are a professional organization of psychologists and students interested in studying psychology, examining personality assessment. Now, I know we'll briefly go into this soon, Joanna. By personality assessment, we don't mean Myers-Briggs, True Colors, what kind of elephant are you on Facebook? I did think a little bit. That's what we were when we came in. We do have the website personality.org, after all, as our website. We are actually more on the clinical side of things. So if you've ever heard of the Rorschach ink blot test, it's a set of cards by Herman Rorschach. They came over to the US in the 30s, and we were actually the National Rorschach Society when we were first founded. We've changed names a couple times over the years, but we're more on, again, as I mentioned, the clinical side. So our members include psychologists that do personality assessment for Red Sox drafts. Our members do personality assessment for fit for trial, immigration cases, police officers, reality TV stars. So we really run the gamut, but we're more on that clinical forensic side of personality assessment, not necessarily the pop psychology that might come to mind when you think of SPA.
So I'm familiar with Myers-Briggs.
Okay.
I've done that. I've done StrengthsFinder. I've done Working Genius. I've done DISC. I've done a whole bunch of those, but that is not what you do.
Correct.
So if I were, I don't know, applying to become a police officer and they did one of these exams, what would they want to know about me that your members could help them?
Yep. So traditionally SPA, and this has been part of our evolution to try to thrive at SPA over the past 5 years, what they're looking for are clinical signs of distress, mania, depression. Are they fit? Is this someone that should be in this high risk position? Every air traffic controller goes through a personality assessment before they are approved. Think about air traffic control. Think about the high risk, the stress that comes with that. So when individuals go through personality assessments, they're trying to see, are they fit to serve in this position? Are they mentally capable to be on trial? Are they going through a diagnosis? Perhaps they've been diagnosed with one thing, but maybe they don't feel like that aligns or fits to them. So usually when you do a personality assessment, it is pretty intensive. So our members and our philosophy is multi-method assessment. So it's not just take one test and then you're done.
Ah.
Taking maybe a test where you are talking about different things. But then there's also a test where you're answering multiple choice questions. And then there's also a clinical interview. Maybe there's bringing in some outside referral sources. So maybe parents are asking assessments about their children as well. So it's really a comprehensive look at an individual. Whereas personality assessments or the pop psychology ones, and again, that's what I thought when I interviewed with SPA, it's maybe a one and done answer. Maybe they're not very reliable or consistent. You mentioned StrengthsFinder. I've taken it 3 times. I've had 3 very different, all with some of the similar themes, but maybe connectedness was number 1 the first time I took it, and now it's number 4. And I just took it 2 weeks ago, and now it's number 8.
Oh, so like it just depended on like how you were feeling that day and like what side of the bed you got up on.
Exactly. Versus, am I introverted or extroverted? That's something that tends to be consistent over time. So our board actually just went through the exercise of defining what personality assessment is. And what's funny, Joanna, is even in the literature, it's hard to define. People haven't been able to define it because some people think personality is baseline. It affects every single part of who we are and what we do, versus other streams of the literature say personality is borderline, it's depression, it's kind of these specific categories. So I think that question or that confusion of what personality assessment is, from your perspective, we still have as an organization, and why I think we went through the exercises of defining personality assessment. And then we're also looking at maybe creating some different communities or committees to address kind of the public perception or this outreach around how we talk about personality assessment from the public's standpoint.
Nathan, is this a big field and is it growing?
So if you look at the technical definition of what makes psychologists different from other mental health fields, so counselors, social workers, et cetera, it originally was assessment. It originally was this concept of coming back from World War I around making sure that our soldiers coming back are okay. That's kind of shifted, and not all psychologists really think about assessment as kind of what makes them unique. It's more around therapy. But what our organization's really trying to do is, assessment is core, though, to what we do as psychologists. Maybe you don't do it, but you need to do assessment training to graduate with a PhD or a PsyD. You need to do, during your internship year, do assessments and write up comprehensive reports and et cetera. But it's not taught as much as it used to be. It's not valued as much. It's not reimbursed in the area. It is a big area, and that's where, as an organization, we've really been trying to rethink and retool what we mean by personality assessment and look at these various places, whether it's business, whether it's industry, whether it's in forensics cases, whether it's in neuroscience, where personality and personality assessment are important, that we're trying to be this hub and spoke out to these other areas. So, Joanna, it depends how you define personality. But we think it is big and focused. And the perception that we get when we're in some of these other sister spaces is, oh, personality, I don't do that. Oh, well, what do you do? Oh, I give these personality assessments. Well, come on down. We have something to talk about.
Right.
There's a perception piece that maybe we need to talk about.
Well, Nathan, we have a lot to talk about when it comes to SPA because you're blowing my mind with all of this. But I am really interested in hearing about your journey. So how did you get to become executive director of SPA?
Absolutely. So I'll kind of start maybe a little bit beforehand. So I'm from the Philadelphia suburbs, went to undergrad for dance and psychology.
Dance and psychology. Amazing combination.
Yep. I unfortunately never finished it, but my senior thesis was looking at boy bands and the effects on the male body psyche. So there definitely was a connection. But and didn't know what I wanted to do after undergrad and worked a lot on college campus. So I went to do my master's in higher education, student affairs administration. They paid for my grad school. I got paid to work. I was like, great, I'll punt for another 2 years. Life brought me to DC. So the person I was dating kind of moved down there. Nonprofit salary, lawyer salary, you know which one you're going to move for. So we moved to DC.
Right.
I actually interned at the professional organization that I was a part of in graduate school. What turned into part-time work, turned into 40 hours of part-time work, turned into them actually creating a role for me. And that was at the National Association of Student Personnel Administration, or NASPA. I remember the moment when I was getting offered 2 weeks before. I'm still kind of loud. I've learned when to be loud, at least now. But it was in an all-staff meeting around a new initiative that they were doing around job placement. having just gone through the process, I went, this sucks for the following X reasons. Again, 23-year-old, didn't really know politics.
You're going to speak your mind.
Exactly. I'm going to speak my mind to this president of this organization that I'm working for. 2 weeks later, they did create a position for me. But that did teach me, I think, a little bit around knowing when to raise your voice and knowing how to raise your voice. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, Joanna, shortly. But I was at NASPA for 14 years, had 7 different roles. 6 of those roles I actually created. So it was a lot of, hey, I see this opportunity. Social media, for example, in 2008, 2009, there was this thing called Facebook and Twitter that these students were on. And I went, hey, we should probably be in this space. Great, Nathan, write a job description, give me a budget, and we'll see what we can do. So I bought myself a MacBook Pro on the company dime, and we created social media techs. So this was 2009. We had lab coats with the Twitter bird on the back. And at conference registration, we were helping people create a Twitter account and kind of learn how to interact and chat. To my last role that I was at NASPA was the Senior Director of Recruitment, Engagement, and Volunteerism. So I was essentially in function, but not necessarily title, the Chief Volunteer Officer. So we had 7 different regions that essentially I was the staff lead. I went to their board meetings, helped run their conferences to diversity and inclusion efforts, to how do we comprehensively look at the member experience and pipeline.
Nathan, that's a lot of trust in you by your CEO to create these positions based on your interests and perhaps your ability to see what lies ahead. Now, I'm going to tell you something about me. I have mostly had jobs where I was the first person. So like you, and I think it shapes your view of the world.
Yes.
Because what happens is you kind of don't take no.
Yes.
Because you kind of do everything that you think needs to get done.
Yeah.
And you make it happen. It's very self-actualizing.
Absolutely, Joanna. And I think a lot of it was, you know, I'm a gay Filipino and I grew up in a white suburb and I was raised Catholic and still identify as Catholic. And I think I've been raised in these spaces that were told, no, you can't be this, but wait, but I am this. So how do I operate and navigate? And, you know, I think not only from an identity place of learning to find my fit, create my spaces, find my chosen family, but when I look at professionally and you mentioned I'm the vice president of NextGen, and I'll mention a little bit more about that after I talk about SPA. You know, what we're trying to do at NextGen is rethink what is association management. We're 2 young queer millennials. Oh. We both are gay dads with young kids, and we don't want transactional relationships with our companies. We want to be able to bring our full selves. I don't want to apologize when my daughter walks into the room because she has a question about homework. I think we've so often operated in this fake barrier of this is my work life, this is my professional life. And I've chosen, and TJ Cote, our owner and founder, has chosen as well to not do that. So at NASPA, you know, I think creating those 7 positions has been great. But what happened, I think, in the last position is there was a creation of a assistant VP suite. They appointed 3 of the 4 positions. The 4th position, they did an open call for. The 4th position, everyone thought I was applying for, but if I wasn't appointed, why was I going to apply? So I loved my time at NASPA. I think I really value and learned, have grown a lot from that. But not that I was actively searching, but this position came up at SPA and I thought I'd throw my hat in the ring.
To be the executive director?
Yeah. So to your earlier point, Joanna, first ED for the organization. So again, seeing that opportunity, it actually started a colleague of mine through the DELP program. So I'm a DELP scholar through ASAE. A DELP scholar actually was the consultant for the organization to create the job description for their first ED.
Man, and that network is strong.
Yep. And actually, funny thing, I was applying for the job he was leaving. I was like, oh, is this the job? And he's like, no, it's not the job. But actually, you might be good for this position too, but they're probably not going to be able to pay your salary. I was an internal candidate for 14 years, Joanna. What I should be paid versus what I was getting paid, unfortunately, sometimes in our field, that isn't always the case.
Yeah.
So it was actually still a bump. And it would be the CEO role. So I applied for the position and came in. So I started in May of 2020. Fun time to start at an organization. Their annual meeting is in March as well. So even though I wasn't fully hired, I was counseling them on what to do, who to talk to, et cetera. And, you know, had been there for about 5 years, was able to create a lot of new processes and we can talk a little bit about that. But about 2 to 3 years ago, the board asked me to relook at the budget.
And why did they do that?
We were deficit spending. You know, I think when I came into the organization, they knew that they needed to invest in the infrastructure. Many times we talk about SPA, or at least with the earlier boards, as a house that needed renovating.
Hmm.
It had great bones. It was a great society. It was a committed set of members. It had a student on that was voting on the board of directors already. There were a lot of great things about it as an organization. It had knob and tube wiring, though.
Hmm.
It had landscaping with overgrown weeds, et cetera. So there was a lot of that investment, a new website, a new database, new strategic plan, new branding that I was able to do in the first 3 to 4 years. And the board wanted to recognize that, but they wanted to see the kind of continued output. And we recognized that to do that, though, we needed to cut back in the staffing expenses. So I needed to cut back in staffing and kind of rethink what could a staffing model look like for less money. Simultaneously, a colleague of mine, TJ, the owner of NextGen AMC, needed to staff up for another organization. He started in 2020 with one of his clients. He was at a larger AMC previously and wanted to move over and start his own gig. Again, a lot because he saw how the model worked at these larger firms and he wanted to try and create something different. He was a fractional CEO for about 3 different organizations, but he knew he needed to staff up for a full service client that he might be able to get in the fall of 25. So he needed the staffing kind of opportunity. I needed something different. So what started as just an individual conversation with TJ and our executive committee turned actually into a full-fledged search for an AMC. So we did an RFP out to about 15 different organizations. And what we ended up seeing was price-wise and cost-wise, really NextGen was the only organization that financially made sense with bringing me and another staff member over and then staffing up with the other clients.
So Nathan, you're now VP at NextGen. You're ED at SPA, but I think you're also ED at a couple of other organizations. I saw something on LinkedIn the other day. So tell us about that and how do you manage all this?
Absolutely. So we officially came over after lots of conversations. And if my volunteer leads are hearing this, kudos to our presidential trio in particular and our treasurer that we're navigating this transition. But we officially came over in June 1st. And actually, since then, we've 3 new clients just in the past 4 or 5 months within there. So as you mentioned, I'm the ED for SPA and I've continued that role. And I'll talk about capacity briefly. I'm also the interim executive director with the Environmental Design Researchers Association. So environmental psychologists, architects, designers, thinking about how place and space interact and how we create more humane and equitable spaces. And then I'm also currently the ED for the National Council of Investigative and Security Services.
Wow.
Kind of other smaller staff roles on these other pieces. But again, being a small staff, a smaller AMC, you know, we need to wear multiple hats. I've always been a multiple hat guy. You know, I think rather than putting on multiple hats, I think we're just kind of turning the hats. I think there's a lot of overlap in the skill sets that we bring. EDRA, in a lot of ways, the environmental designers remind me a lot of SPA 4 to 5 years ago. They're looking at building infrastructure. They're looking at doing a new database. They're looking at creating a strategic plan and a strategic framework. And for me, it's about efficiencies. I think one of the things we try to do at NextGen also is technology and how we can use ChatGPT, Asana for project management, templates to make things more efficient. But then also at SPA, my role has changed a little bit. I'm doing now mostly executive level work, whereas previous to the AMC, I was also doing all of the meeting planning and all of the budget reconciliation.
So you legit can be a part-time ED.
Exactly. Yeah, because I've been able to offset some of these other more time-consuming and frankly, time-draining things that an executive shouldn't be doing to our other teammates at NextGen so that I can more focus on the vision, the mission, and the kind of project management overall for the organization.
So I got a question about this because I do have a fair number of EDs on the podcast who wear multiple hats. Is that tough to navigate with your clients? Because on the one hand, they probably know, especially the board, they know that you're part-time, but it's hard to maybe not have expectations that you're available 40, 50 hours a week. So how do you manage that? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, and that's definitely something I'm still learning, Joanna, to be fully transparent. I think TJ has been great to kind of give his insight and expertise and background. I think some of it comes down to, and again, I think what we think at least makes NextGen different is kind of our three values. So one value of being intentional, another value of being inclusive, and another value of being inspiring.
Oh, I love that. Being inspiring.
Gotta love the alliteration. So, you know, intentional in our partnerships. So I think especially when we're looking at who we're partnering with, we're fortunate that we're at this place now where we don't need new clients. We're staffed. We feel like we're comfortable. Not that we'd say no if the right client came along, but that we can kind of be selective and be intentional with who we're trying to work with. We're trying to be inclusive in our practices. So obviously this is a DEISJ lens. And thinking about how we're making sure that equity kind of approaches all the work. I know for me personally, and I believe also for TJ, I believe that's what will make the next associations over the next couple of years and decades thrive and survive. Mm. I think you can't ignore being aligned with your values. I think you can't ignore thinking about how equity and justice, and this is in the sense of everyone having a voice, not just certain people. So it's not necessarily silencing certain perspectives, but I think making sure everyone can raise their perspective and voice. And then to the inspiring thing, I think that's inspiring future generations through meaningful collaboration. And I think to the point around clients and the boards and making sure is being very transparent around deadlines and building trust. I remember training I went through very, very early in my career around just kind of asking questions and project management. And they said the number one reason problems arise is you don't give clear deadlines in your emails.
Oh, 100%.
Joanna, can you get me that information? Joanna, by Thursday, could you get me that information because I need it for this project in the other area? Asking the same question, but having those two other elements of giving a reason of why it's important and then a deadline, then makes it clear for the other person to say, actually, Nathan, I have something due Thursday. Can we do Friday?
Because you asked the question, now you can have a negotiation and then there's clarity between the two of you.
Exactly.
Nathan, we have a fundamental at Matrix. We have these values. We call them fundamentals. And one of them is everything has a timeline. And when a client says, oh, I don't have a timeline, we always say, oh God, that's like death, right? Because to me, not having a deadline means like, can I get it to you in January?
Yep.
You know, but they might be like, God, I didn't think it was going to take that long. I was thinking like maybe a couple of weeks. Aha, you have a timeline.
Exactly. Yes, there is a deadline. Yep. Yep.
There is a deadline. The other thing is, Nathan, I can't tell you now when we say we're going to launch this on Monday, we give you a time because my team will say, oh, we're going to launch on Monday at 5 and you're thinking 9.
Yep. Yep.
Always define the timeline.
Yes. And I think that's been one of those pieces that, and again, I'm newer. I'm only 3 months, 4 months into this component, but I've noticed when I did not give a timeline or I said, oh, I'll get that to you. That's where I think then questions arise from our board going, hey, where's this document or where's this thing versus, hey, you know, here's that piece. I know it's not personality assessment as my board thinks about it, but you know, I am trained in Clifson StrengthsFinder as well. And the most recent assessment that I took actually moved a ranger into my top 5.
For my listeners who are not familiar with StrengthsFinder, why don't you talk to us about that?
Absolutely.
I'm a big fan, by the way.
So if you're not familiar with StrengthsFinder, it is from Gallup, and it was based off the concept of positive psychology. What they were looking at is, these sorts of people seem to be really successful in these jobs. They're more engaged. They're more likely to be retained. They get really great reviews. What is it about these sorts of people and what are they doing versus this other set? If we think about getting a D to a C versus a B to an A, sometimes we focus on the D to the C. I own that with my third grader. But if I think about it, it is a lot less effort to get that B to A. So StrengthsFinder and Clifton, there are 34 different themes or characterizations, and they break them down into 4 different areas: executing, influencing, relationship building, and strategic thinking. And they're kind of broken down. And from a Gallup standpoint, they give you your top 5. Now they give you to the top 34. Yay, capitalism. You're really supposed to focus on that top 5, top 10 really is where the science kind of suggests. What was interesting, and I forget where it was in previous assessments, but a ranger has now become in my top 5.
Oh.
And the concept of a ranger is making situations or arranging things to get jobs done. And that's in my executing area. I also have within executing a 34, so my bottom, a 32, a 29. So I will own executing not necessarily always my biggest strength.
Oh, interesting. But StrengthsFinder is a pop psychology
yes.
quiz, according to your definition, and not necessarily what your members use.
No, but well, and I think the distinction though, Joanna, is, and my members will agree to this, the pop psychology will give a language that everyone can use to enter a conversation.
Ah.
And I think that is the benefit of pop psychology from a non-clinical perspective. It gives us an avenue for us to understand each other a little bit more. We shouldn't diagnose with it. We shouldn't expect to like a life or death case, but there's some use and there's some fun that comes along. But I offer all this in that Arrangers now into my top five. And I find, especially now working with multiple clients, but over the years that now I'm thinking, okay, what's the end deadline? Let me start there, backtrack the deadlines from there. What are the resources I need to bring in? Who are the people that need to be involved? So again, to that point of how I got to be an ED, how I got to this place, I think I've focused on kind of my strengths and my networks, my communities to get to this area. And that's where I do think to service multiple clients, to service multiple boards at one time, it's being transparent, it's being clear with deadlines. It's utilizing technology to think about how we can make those deadlines clearer or have a repository of that information. But then it's also kind of utilizing your networks and your connections to get the job done.
I love it all. Let's turn to SPA.
Absolutely.
I am curious about your upcoming conference. You're in Canada next year. What's new with conference and how's it going?
Sure. So we are in Toronto, Canada. We've been around since 1932. This is the first time that we've actually been outside of the United States, and we have about 10% international membership. So when I had the opportunity to work with the board to determine future convention locations, I really thought we needed a Canadian city, and the opportunity and price point wise, Toronto fell to the list. I jokingly said this to the CBB when I visited. They own it though too. Toronto's kind of the like United States light. There's a lot of, I think, similarities to New York, Chicago, some of our big cities, great transportation, great food scene, easy flight in and out. So I knew for our members, and again, 10% are international, it would be an easy or a place safer for them to adjust. When we signed the contract, we were in a different political situation though. So what we're finding is one of our concerns and newer concerns is in particular visa status, and both for, I think, graduate students or faculty that aren't worried getting into Canada, but potentially getting back into the United States.
So your faculty and grad students who maybe aren't U.S. citizens, but working in the U.S.
Correct.
They're worried about going to your conference in Canada and perhaps they won't be let back in.
Yes. So that's part of the concern. We also have had conferences this year where we actually wrote letters for our international attendees. We were in Denver in March this year, and then we had another conference in Minnesota in June. And, you know, there were stories, there were YouTube clips of people at the border not being able to get in. Luckily, our members haven't had that issue yet. But, you know, I think there is that concern, frankly, for our international members and probably your international members too, if they haven't raised that concern yet. But one of the other things the board has decided to do as well is we actually created a visa scholarship this year. We didn't know this until some students brought it up. Some countries, Canada included, there are different visa requirements and they might need to apply. And there might be costs to go to Canada versus not for the US. So we've created this other opportunity for funding for our students and early career professionals to be able to get into Canada. One of the nice things, though, being in Canada and to kind of counteract some of this concern with numbers is we've leaned even more into our hub and spoke philosophy of partnerships. So as I talked about earlier, personality assessment touches many different places. And depending on who you are, you might think personality assessment is relevant or not. What we've been doing is going through the networks of smaller psychological associations that maybe don't have full-time staff or maybe don't have the infrastructure to host a meeting or maybe post-COVID haven't hosted a meeting yet. And we're co-partnering with them to co-locate a conference, essentially. We've been doing this since 2023, and we essentially run registration through our system. We give their members the member rate to our conference, and vice versa. They give our members the member rate to their conference, whether it's a pre-conference or a simultaneous conference. And then we're able to reutilize the F&B that we already have contracted, the hotel rooms, but then also learn from other perspectives and get some additional vantage points from our organization. One of the partnerships we're doing this year, they have a lot of Canadian members. So it just works out that, you know, we're in Canada. We actually are CE approved. We applied to be CE approved in Canada as well. So we're excited that we think that this potential kind of lower numbers for some populations, that with these partnerships, we think we might be able to increase registration and then kind of mitigate the concerns of being international, at least for the year. The last thing I'll just briefly share as well, Joanna, is the exchange rate is favorable for us. So we are finding that things are frankly going to be a little bit cheaper. And again, Toronto being one of the easier cities to get into, we have partnerships with some other airlines, and the CVB and Destinations Canada has been fantastic. There's actually a rebate program to get some of the taxes back for companies that host in Canada. So if you haven't hosted in Canada yet, I definitely encourage you, if you can go across the border, I definitely invite y'all to consider and look into that potential opportunity.
So Nathan, I'm fascinated by this idea of partnership with your conference. How many of these organizations have partnered with you at this conference? And I love this idea because essentially you're creating something bigger, but also sharing the costs, or really kind of sharing the discounts, if you will. If you have maybe only 100 people, you couldn't put on a conference at this scale and you wouldn't get the hotel discounts, for example.
Yeah.
This is lovely.
And again, to that point, so one of our organizations that we've been quote unquote incubating decided this year not to partner with us. And ultimately for them, they recognize the, they call it the professionalization that this partnership offers to their conference. They also recognize the fees are a little bit higher. So this year, at least, they're going to try and do it back on a college campus, which is where they originally were hosting this company. We've probably done 4 or 5 of these partnerships over the past 3 or 4 years. Some of them have continued, some have been one-off, some are still partners for other virtual conferences, just not our in-person. You know, I think the other benefit too is, and this is something you need to be clear in your affiliation agreement and make sure that both companies are okay, but we have more leads now. These are people that are relevant to our community. So we're able to not even push. We know some of them joined for the member rate to stay for our conference as well. Even though they were getting it because of their original conference, they have that opportunity. So, you know, I think for us, we have a database that kind of allows us to have leads to do kind of these partner memberships, quote unquote, or at least member pricing for the different tickets for the event. And, you know, I think there's that economies of scale. And also for these communities, some of them, they wouldn't be able to host a conference like this, or they haven't been at least since COVID. So it's created a great way for partnership. And I think this has been key for us. Almost all of the connections have been through a member of our organization. So one organization we're partnering with in Canada this year, our will be president, she's president-elect, we switch over December 31st, our president at the conference was actually president of this other organization previously as well. The current president is actually a member of our organization. So a lot of these communities aren't that far out from us. They're all psychology related. And I think that's where there's been the connection. But I think that's what's afforded us this opportunity of partnership. And I think in a lot of ways, Joanne, I think that's, you know, being a Filipino American, that's part of it. It's community. And I think so often, some in our community association space, you know, see these people as competition. And I think I encourage our board to see them as collaborators instead.
And partners, yeah. Speaking of being Filipino, it's October 2025. And October, among other things, is Filipino American History Month. What does it mean to you to be Filipino American today?
Yeah, absolutely. So the history piece, I think, is one of the important parts to key in on this. And I talk a lot about this with my equity and inclusion work, is that so often we are taught a certain history, but whose history is that? And I think that's the piece that I didn't really identify. You know, I was part of the Filipino club in Philadelphia. I danced all the traditional dances. I ate Filipino food. But it wasn't really till college, and I took an Asian diaspora class, that I really thought about what does it mean to be Asian American, though. Growing up on the East Coast, I think not having a lot of different communities, I was lumped into this kind of not white perspective. I think in a lot of spaces, and even in DC, I get Spanish spoken to me about once a week.
Right, right.
You know, especially Filipinos, some Filipinos being darker and just perspective. But I bring up this idea of history and this diaspora class, because I didn't know until that class that Filipinos were in the U.S. in New Orleans in the 1600s and 1700s. I didn't know that we were banned from these different places. I didn't know about the oppression that our people and Filipinos went through because of the histories that we were taught or weren't taught. You know, I think especially on the East Coast and especially in the U.S., we have not reconciled slavery. Frankly, from my perspective, we don't have what Canada has in the Truth and Reconciliation Day. We don't acknowledge, I think, our true history. And I think because we don't acknowledge it, that leads to the current struggles that we're going through of, well, who says that's accurate? Well, that's fake news. You know, my son or daughter doesn't need to learn that. But I think what this month offers me is this opportunity to relearn our history, to relearn what it means to be Filipino. And for me, and I think it's hard for me to separate being Filipino with being Catholic, with being gay, with being a parent of three, with being a working parent, with this idea of I'm operating in this borderland space or this in-between. I'm doing my dissertation right now and looking at how racially minoritized volunteer leaders navigate structures of norms within their professional organizations. And norms are just the way things that have been done. That's the layman's way of explaining that. And I've really thought about, well, as a Filipino American, as a queer practicing Catholic, as a man in some of these spaces, a cis man in some of these spaces, how I'm operating in the in-betweens, where sometimes I bring in privilege, but sometimes I don't have that privilege. And how do I create opportunities, create conversations, create ways that we can live in our authentic selves and our authentic perspectives? So for me, being Filipino American, thinking about Filipino Heritage Month is really this idea of being able to try to live a more authentic life and trying to find your truth.
Nathan, what are you reading or watching that you would want to share with us?
So I'm still in the thick of my dissertation stage. So I don't know if these are the top hits or kind of perspectives, but three books that come to mind. So first would be Borderlands or La Frontera, The New Mestiza by Gloria Anzaldúa. She's the kind of one of those main perspectives of this interstitial place, the in-between. And again, I think obviously not being indigenous, not being, well, depends how you define it.
Depends, right?
The U.S. at least, some don't consider Filipinos indigenous or consider them necessarily Latino or Chicano, but I think there's a lot of similarities. So I think that's one book that I've been rereading. The second is The Latinos of Asia, How Filipino Americans Break the Rules of Race by Anthony Ocampo. This is a 2016-2017 book. So again, kind of an older study, but he just kind of talks about how, like we've been talking, Filipinos are in this kind of weird place. We have a lot of colonialism, not only the Spanish, but the US most recently to the Japanese even before that. And, you know, we've kind of been this conquered country and kind of what that looks like. The last book, and this is now almost 20 years ago, but I remember reading it in grad school and it really affecting me, is Covering The Hidden Assault on Our Civil Rights by Kenji Yoshino. And that book, I think the most salient that came to mind is he looked from a case law perspective, kind of how, and again, this is 2006, but how the law was changing. So one of the cases was around a flight attendant having natural hair, but natural hair being against the dress code, and how kind of these, again, implicit norms that we operate in operate, though, from this perspective of normalcy, of sometimes those with the majority or power, and how we need to kind of rethink and again relearn kind of our history and perspective. So, you know, not ones I'm actively reading. They were kind of some of the greatest hits, I guess.
Very foundational, it sounds like.
Yeah, foundational pieces that definitely have informed my perspectives.
Nathan, this has been an amazing interview. Happy Filipino American History Month.
India.
I am going to check out these books. I'm also checking out some Filipino dramas. I'm a K-drama fan, but I'm checking out some Filipino dramas, and I am doubling down on Filipino desserts this month.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Nathan, let's have you back next year, because it sounds like you're doing amazing things at SPA, these two other organizations, and NextGen. Congratulations.
Thank you, Joanna. And hopefully it'll be Dr. Victoria by that point, so more than happy to come back.
Thanks for listening to Associations Thrive, We're so glad to have you here. You know, my personal mission and the mission of my company, Matrix Group International, is to help associations and nonprofits increase membership, generate revenue, and thrive in the digital space. I want to hear stories of how your organization is thriving in today's challenging landscape. Please apply to be on my show by going to podcast.matrixgroup.net. By the way, do you need help with a digital initiative? Maybe it's a website redesign, a new membership database, or a hybrid meeting that you're planning. I'd love to connect with you. Please visit the Matrix Group website at matrixgroup.net. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode of Associations Thrive. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a 5-star rating, post a comment, and share it with your colleagues and friends.